Thank you, James Henry Bedell, for the cool original Climate Champion tunes. And welcome to episode 42 of The Climate Champions. I'm Lee Krivat, and each week I publish a new episode with a new climate champion as my guest. This week's guest is Larry Peranich, a retired expert in predictive analytics and analytics software development, now volunteering with Citizens Climate Lobby, CCL. If you or someone you know is a climate champion, please let me know at www.krivatenergyinnovations.com. Citizens Climate Lobby is a nonprofit, nonpartisan, grassroots advocacy organization focused on national policies to address climate change. CCL exists to create the political will for climate solutions by enabling individual breakthroughs in the exercise of personal and political power. By building upon shared values rather than partisan divides and empowering their supporters to work in keeping with the concerns of their local communities, CCL works toward the adoption of fair, effective, and sustainable climate change solutions. If you want an unprecedented opportunity to connect with stakeholders and explore what's next in the utility sector, join me at GridConnects in Washington, D.C., December 10th through 12th. I'll be recording an episode of The Climate Champions live the morning of the 10th, followed by world-class experts exploring diverse perspectives and uncovering market innovations poised to redraw the electric utility landscape. Secure your spot at GridConnects by registering now at GridConnects, and that's an X instead of a C, .com. Larry earned a BS in nuclear engineering and an MS and PhD in experimental plasma physics from the University of Wisconsin-Madison. He joined General Atomics and focused on helping to make nuclear fusion a reality. But when the funding dried up, he moved into predictive analytics and analytics software development, researching, implementing, and applying machine learning algorithms to address real business needs, such as financial fraud detection, brokerage margin risk, and targeted marketing. After he retired, he began his quest to help mitigate climate change, his original motivation for choosing a career in nuclear energy. Welcome to The Climate Champions. I'm Lee Krivat. I'm sitting here with Larry Peranich. He's retired, and he's currently volunteering with the Citizens Climate Lobby. Welcome to the Climate Champions.
Thank you for having me.
I'm very excited to talk to you about Citizens Climate Lobby. They actually reached out to me listening to the podcast, and we've been discussing who should be on the show, and they chose you.
Yeah, well, I'm a Republican, which is a little bit unusual in this side of the climate argument, and guessing that's why they chose me.
Yeah, I don't know why it should matter, Republican or Democrat, because to become a scientist or to understand engineering or to understand data or living on this planet, that doesn't depend on your political party.
Yeah, it's really unfortunate this has become politicized. I've been thinking about this a lot lately. I think the reason is there's a lot of people on both sides of the argument that are convinced the only way to solve this is a massive regulatory government intrusion into our private lives. And maybe some people on the left are okay with that, but people on the right aren't. And I think that misperception that that's the only way to deal with it is what caused a lot of Republicans to say, oh, I can't go there. I'm not going to admit that climate change exists. As a scientist, though, I pretty much have to look at the data. This is something that I first heard about back in the 70s when I was in high school, before it got politicized. And I was a science nut back then and just said, yeah, that makes a lot of sense. And it actually influenced where I went in my career.
So I was going to ask you what your motivating moment was, and it sounds like it was pretty early on.
Yeah, and it made sense. I was probably reading a Scientific American article or something like that. And at that point, the scientists were saying, well, we're not sure how serious this is, but this is something we need to talk about. So it was just always there for me, always a concern.
For me, I didn't understand how drastic the impacts could potentially be or will potentially be now. So I accepted it as, yes, this is what the science and the data says. So something's there, but I didn't get motivated to do anything about it for a long time.
Yeah, well, I actually decided what I decided to do in grad school was research on nuclear fusion. And one of the big reasons for that is that's a carbon-free source of energy, if we can ever get it working. Hopefully we do. And that's what decided me to do that. Unfortunately, after a few years of working that professionally, the budget got cut in the 1991 recession, and I went on and did other things for the rest of my career. But it's always been in the background bugging me that I was worried about this. And once I retired, then I had the chance to do something about it. It took me a couple of years to find Citizens Climate Lobby, but they're the organization that sort of has taught me how to have a voice in this.
So when you retired, you actually wanted to do something.
Yeah. As a matter of fact, my wife found a online course that UCSD and Scripps Institute of Oceanography were teaching, and it was more about the politics and sociology around climate change. They certainly talked about the results that their modeling was showing. They didn't get into the details of the physics, but one of the things that they were stressing in this is the concept of a trusted messenger. So if just some scientist goes and wants to talk to a bunch of Republicans, and the Republicans have the idea that this scientist is some liberal socialist, it's not going to carry any weight. And the example, Richard Somerville, who is retired now from Scripps, gave an example that he knows a couple of evangelical Christians who are climate scientists. And he says they can go into a evangelical church and have instant credibility because they're part of the tribe, as it were. And since I'm a Republican, that's what sort of struck me. It's, hey, you know, I'm a lifelong Republican. Maybe I can have credibility where some other people won't. And that's what really drove me to start wanting to talk publicly. And then it was, how do I do this? I actually approached Scripps and asked if they had a public outreach thing. Well, since I wasn't associated with them, they didn't want me speaking for them. And then when I finally found Citizens Climate Lobby, got some training from them, and I've been giving talks now, and now I'm doing a podcast.
I'm glad that you as a Republican are speaking on behalf of climate change mitigation, but I'm also not happy that that has to be the case, that we have to say Republican. You tried to explain it. I don't understand why this is divided along Republican and Democrat.
So one of the big messages from Citizens Climate Lobby is that there are bipartisan solutions. We've got a bill in the House. It was introduced by a Republican and a couple Democrats. I'll be honest, it's gotten a lot more Democratic support than Republican, but there are a lot of Republican organizations or organizations that are at least associated with the right that are pushing something like that bill. So we have hope that we can actually get something bipartisan through Congress.
Why is climate change mitigation personally important to you?
I think there's a bunch of reasons. One of the reasons I'm a Republican is I'm a deficit hawk because I think it's really immoral for my generation to be running up this huge debt and then dumping it in the laps of future generations for them to deal with. And it's exactly the same thing with the climate. My generation has enjoyed the benefits of burning fossil fuels. They're cheap, they're great sources of energy, but it's the future generations that are going to have to deal with the results of that. And it's exactly the same argument for me. On another side, I've always really felt more spiritual when I'm in a natural setting. I love backpacking and hiking, and I want that environment preserved for future generations. I mean, it's selfish. I want to preserve for myself, but the worst effects of climate change are probably coming after I'm gone. So it's the future generations that I want to have that enjoyment that I get.
Since much of the impact is going to come later, it's hard for it to be personal on you. It really has to be personal about another generation or the future in some way.
I mean, we are seeing effects now, certainly. Sea level rise, if you're living in Miami, you're seeing streets flooding that didn't used to flood. Hurricanes seem to be more severe than they used to be. Here in California, we're getting perhaps more stronger drought cycles, things like that. I'm lucky that I'm upper middle class and, you know, I can afford to run the air conditioner if I need to and stuff like that. So there are certainly personal impacts, but they're not nearly as direct as affecting other people now. I mean, there are parts of the world where humans are barely able to live there because it gets really hot, get these horrible heat waves. And if we get another few degrees warmer, that can just basically make parts of the world uninhabitable, and that could happen in the next couple decades during my lifetime.
Other things that could be more short-term would be potentially more diseases or diseases that we haven't seen before, or even food shortages that, because certain climates won't be able to produce what they do today.
Yeah. So the Centers for Disease Control is concerned that mosquitoes and ticks are moving into areas where it used to be too cold for them. And right now we've got, what's this, Eastern equine encephalitis that's mosquito-carried, Zika, West Nile virus, all these things are moving into areas where it used to be too cold for those disease vectors. And in the areas where the vectors used to exist, they have a longer season because it's getting warmer earlier in the spring and staying warmer later in the fall. So those are things that are affecting us. And as you know, since I go out backpacking and get bitten by mosquitoes, I guess I worry about that.
Also, because the ecosystem is changing, we might be losing some creatures that control populations of other creatures, and that could also throw things out of balance.
Oh, yeah. Particularly in the oceans, I think. That's something people here in San Diego maybe feel a little more attuned to, is we, a few years ago, had, quote, the blob out in the Pacific, where it's this big area of hot water, and it drastically changed fish populations and so on, and now they're saying that maybe another one's building up.
When you meet people that don't believe that climate change is something of importance, or they don't even believe the science behind it, how do you communicate with them to convince them otherwise?
I originally started with the science. I mean, I'm a scientist, and there's this kind of feeling that, well, if we just show them more data, clearly, if they're intelligent, they're going to get it. And there was a great quote I heard a couple months ago. Research shows that showing people research does not work. Because these aren't really scientific arguments. They're more arguments about deeply held values. And again, this is why I'm stressing that Republicans, you know, again, this is a generalization, but Republicans tend to find government interference in our lives a violation of our liberty. And that's a deeply held value that Republicans have. So when I give these talks to people, typically Rotary clubs, where I'm hoping there's a substantial fraction of the audience that is politically conservative, I start off with, what does the military say about climate change? Because Republicans tend to respect the military. I certainly do. These are people that are risking their lives to keep me safe. And the military is very concerned about climate change. They view it as a national security threat. It's both weakening our infrastructure here in the United States, particularly coastal bases that are getting flooded or hit by hurricanes. And the military says that they're worried that if you have an area that's already politically unstable somewhere else in the world and you hit it with a drought or flooding or some other disaster caused by climate change, that just is more likely to tip those areas into instability and require a U.S. military intervention. I actually talk about what the oil companies say about climate change. Exxon, on their website, I don't know if I get this quote exactly right, but it's something like, the risk of climate change is real and the risk warrants action. Carbon emissions are warming the atmosphere. And a Chevron spokesman said a couple of years that Chevron accepts the scientific consensus on climate change. And that, I think, is maybe the most critical quote that I use, because there's a lot of people that don't understand that there really is a scientific consensus on climate change. I think maybe the way the media portrays things, where they always have one person from one side of the argument, one person from the other side of the argument, a lot of people, when there's polling done on this, people feel that it's 50-50 in the scientific community, and it's not really. It's more like 95-5.
I think even the five are a questionable five. They don't say that it's garbage or it doesn't exist. They just don't accept the findings as conclusive.
Yeah, either that or they're not as convinced that the warming is going to be as extreme as the middle of the modeling shows it's going to be.
It's not a zero.
Right.
They're not giving it a zero.
There are probably a few people that do, but in any scientific field, there are always people on the extreme. There's a gentleman who won the Nobel Prize for inventing polymerase chain reaction, which is something that's used in genetic laboratories all over the world. And yet he was convinced that AIDS was not caused by the HIV virus. There's always these outliers in the scientific community.
You mentioned Chevron, but Shell has been buying clean technology companies all over the place.
Yeah, you know, I think the oil companies see what's coming. They, much as they want to pump oil, I mean, it's an easy way to earn a lot of money, and they have huge assets that they're carrying on their books, all these underground pools of oil, that if they can't pump that out, they have to write that off, and that's going to be a huge hit to their stock price and so on. But they know what's coming. I think they're intelligent people, and they realize that in the long term, they're going to have to move into a cleaner future. And I forget which oil, I just saw yesterday, I don't remember which oil company it was, but they were making a big deal about reducing the amount of carbon emissions from their processing of oil and how they're putting a lot of effort into that.
When I used to speak a lot about electric vehicles, I would try to excite the entire audience, Republicans and Democrats, conservatives and liberal. And so what I used to say, and I used to tweet, red, white, and blue, and green too. And I used to explain that electric vehicles allow us not to rely on foreign oil and not to be involved as much in the entire mess of trading oil, because we could produce our own energy and we can produce it on our roof. I have solar on my roof. I drive electric. I'm independent.
We have solar on our roof too. We bought a Prius back before there was a plug-in option, so I'm still driving that.
They go for a long time.
Yes, they do.
You mentioned that your old method for trying to convince people was to show them data, but you've moved off of that. Many of my listeners have told me they would like the data to be talked about just a little more than it is, because usually we just talk about the effects and how obvious it is. So can you still talk about the data just a little bit one more time for me?
Yeah, and again, I'm not a climate scientist, so I don't understand all the details of the climate models, but my background is in physics, and the greenhouse effect is very basic physics. We've understood this since the late 1800s. We know that the greenhouse effect is real. If there were no greenhouse gases in our atmosphere, it's actually a very straightforward calculation. By that I mean sort of intro college physics level, that the Earth would be about 60 degrees colder than it is now. So we'd have glaciers here in San Diego instead of our beautiful sunny weather.
So we need something to create some warming effect.
Yeah, and the naturally occurring level of the greenhouse effect is great. That's what gives us our current climate, well, the climate we had before we started mucking around with it.
And trees need carbon dioxide. They give up oxygen. We're not, nobody is saying zero.
Right. So the problem is that we've increased the amount of carbon dioxide by about 50% over what was naturally occurring before the start of the Industrial Revolution. We're lucky that it doesn't mean the temperature's gone up 50%. The curve sort of bends over. It never totally flattens out, but there's sort of diminishing effects from the amount of carbon dioxide. And we're actually lucky, because we'd have probably killed ourselves before we realized what was going on if it had gone up that strongly. But yeah, it's the problem with carbon dioxide as a greenhouse gas is it stays in the atmosphere for thousands of years. Well, the atmosphere and the whole climate system, it dissolves in the ocean, it comes out of the ocean, it gets picked up by plants, it gets released when those plants decay. But it stays in that system for thousands of years. So basically all the extra carbon dioxide that we've added to the atmosphere from the start of the Industrial Revolution, almost all of that is still there. And that's why we have to worry about not only reducing our carbon output, but probably trying to figure out how to get it out of the atmosphere using some engineering approaches if we're going to keep the temperature down to where scientists and politicians tell us we want to keep it.
The most interesting method of doing that I've heard is out of Salk Institute. They have a harnessing plants initiative to enable plants to keep more of the CO2 that they absorb in the ground as opposed to releasing it when they die.
Yeah, you talk about the Great Plains before European settlers showed up. The soil was this incredible organic mix that went down 10, 15 feet. Unfortunately, when we started plowing up all the prairie soil and exposing it to the winds, a lot of that's blown away and decayed and gone back into the atmosphere.
What people are used to is that humans mess up the earth a bit, and you're just talking about another way that we're messing it up a bit. But then scientists come in and they figure out solutions. and say, well, here's how we can fix this. We can make a lot more food, even though there's more people, because here's these new farming methods. Mm-hmm. And I think that a lot of people believe that we'll just come up with solutions to fix the climate change problem without having to worry about it. The scientists will just fix it. But I think many people are concerned now that we're not just going to fix it, that we need a lot of political will behind this. And that's going to require a lot of people caring in order to actually come up with a set of solutions that will fix it.
Yeah, the concern I have about relying on scientists to fix it is people talk about geoengineering, maybe blowing sulfate particles up into the stratosphere. We've seen this happen naturally with volcanoes. When you get a big volcanic eruption, it blows sulfate up into the stratosphere. And yes, it does cool the Earth down. But the problem is it also drastically changes rainfall patterns. So there's areas of the world that are heavily populated that end up in drought. And scientists are saying, well, we don't know how to deal with that if we do the sulfate thing.
Yeah. I think it also reduces the amount of sun that gets through so that crops don't grow as well.
Yeah, I haven't looked at it in detail. That's something I haven't focused on. But your point about political will, I mean, that's what Citizens Climate Lobby is all about. We are totally focused on building the political will to get a bipartisan bill through Congress that's going to effectively address climate change. It's not going to be the be-all and end-all, but there's a bill that was introduced earlier this year, and its targets are to reduce U.S. carbon emissions by 40% by 2030 and 90% by 2050. And that gets us very close to what the scientists are telling us we need to do. There might be other approaches that are needed, but this would be a big step in the right direction.
If we can get the ball moving, then we can move it faster as we see the need. But if we don't have it moving, we can't do anything. And I think that's what you're talking about, building momentum.
Yeah, I actually went out to Washington, D.C. last November and lobbied Congress. It's the first time I've done that. I plan to do it again in the future. I give talks at Rotary clubs. I try to get letters to the editor published in the Union Tribune. Apparently that's important for, I'm a scientist. I don't do politics. I'm an introvert. I'm shy. I may not sound like it, but I really am. This is, doing something like this is very much out of my comfort zone. But apparently getting letters to the editor published is important because the people in the congressional offices read those. They're trying to get a measure of what is the temperature of different things in the public's view. And so there's all these things that Citizens Climate Lobby is asking us to do. And it's interesting to start learning about politics, inserting myself into this. Like I say, it's definitely out of my comfort zone, but I'm trying to get myself educated and do the right thing here.
So you've talked a bit about Citizens Climate Lobby and what you do, which is a question I usually ask. Is there anything you want to add about Citizens Climate Lobby or about your role?
Well, yeah, I'd like to talk a little bit about how I got hooked up with Citizens Climate Lobby instead of some other environmental organizations. I had attended some meetings of other environmental organizations, yet I didn't really feel like I belonged there, and partially because of my political views. I have nothing against Democrats. I'm married to one. But the attitudes of the people at some of these other organizations, and I don't want to name names, but I just didn't feel that that was the right organization for me. And how I hooked up with CCL is I actually went to a talk. It was billed as a multi-religious discussion of climate change. And there was a woman there, Judy, who was with Citizens Climate Lobby, and after she talked, and she's very progressive. After she talked, I went up to her and I said, well, I'm a Republican scientist who's very concerned about climate change. And she looked at me and she brought her hands up, you know, almost in an imploring position. And she said, we need you. And it was really, you know, it's always, everyone wants to be needed. And the thing I like about Citizens Climate Lobby is that they are, I would say, aggressively nonpartisan. We are totally focused on getting a bipartisan bill through Congress. That's our only focus, and everything else stays outside. So there are people in there that are very progressive. I'm moderately conservative, and we certainly disagree on things, but that all stays outside. And we all focus on what we're trying to get done. And this is the environmental organization that I feel really not only comfortable, but welcome in. it's that approach. It's when we go lobby Congress, even there are offices that we know they're not on our side and they're not too likely to switch, but we go in with an attitude of appreciation and respect and gratitude. We're gracious that they're meeting with us. We appreciate that they may not agree with us on everything on the ecology, but at least there's something that they're doing that we can agree on. And we just try to be nice. And they actually, we've been told that, you know, even though they disagree with us, they like to see us because we don't yell at them. I mean, if you're a congressional aide, you kind of have to be polite to anyone that comes in, and regardless of how they're behaving, we just try to be nice.
So personally, I believe this is a crisis. I don't think we have a lot of time. I think we need to move faster than we are now, and we need to go as hard as we possibly can, as soon as we can. That being said, I am naturally somebody that wants to bring people together. I want everybody to see this as important and together move forward. But I do see a division where there are sides, where one side is trying to completely ignore the situation and even make it worse, and the other side is trying to browbeat to attack climate change. And I do cheer for the browbeating side because I want climate change to be mitigated, but I don't think it's the right way. I do think we need to move together somehow, but I do understand the argument from some that it's too late to convince everybody. We just need to move forward at this point.
Yeah, I think there's room for all sorts of approaches to this. There's certainly a great need to make it publicly more visible. And that's where the browbeating comes in. I mean, the kids with the Friday protests, I think that's great because it's making it more visible. On the other hand, if we're going to try and force something through, we're basically betting the future of the planet on Democrats not only taking the White House, which looks like it, at least the polling right now, looks like it may happen, although the polls were wrong last time around, but we also need the Democrats to have 60 votes in the Senate. And I just don't see that happening in this next election. And if we're betting the future of the planet on that, what do we do if that doesn't happen? And that's why I think a bipartisan approach is really necessary. It's frustratingly slow, I will admit. But if we can get a bipartisan bill through Congress, it's a lot harder for Republicans to come around later and try and remove it. I mean, that's what happened with Obamacare is, you know, as Democrats had the majority they needed, they pushed that through. And Republicans have been fighting and trying to repeal it ever since. And it was one vote. It was John McCain that kept that from happening. That's kind of close. I don't want that to happen to a good climate bill.
Yeah, every 4 to 8 years, we don't want everything to change and what we believe in as a country to change that drastically. I have a friend who used to say to me, it doesn't matter whether a Republican or a Democrat wins because they all hug the middle anyway and policies don't change that much. But I think we'd all agree policies really change a lot now. And so if you don't have bipartisan agreement, you really don't have a direction.
Yeah, we talked earlier about how polarizing this issue is, and it turns out there's polling that indicates that climate change is actually more politically polarizing than gun control, believe it or not. It's probably the most polarizing issue in the country right now, and that's why I'm really glad that we're starting to see Republican leaders come out and say this is an issue. Mitt Romney's been saying it for a while. Even Lindsey Graham, he and some other people formed what they call the Theodore Roosevelt Caucus to come up with conservative approaches to environmental problems. And he was asked about climate change, and he said, I'm tired of getting beat up about this. When 90% of the scientists are saying something, I'm going to go with the 9, not the 1. And that's really important for these Republican leaders to come out. And that's kind of why I'm going out and saying, hey, I'm a Republican, and I think this is an important issue. I'm certainly not as important in people's view as Lindsey Graham. But we're tribal, and when we see all the members of our tribe saying the same thing, we're going to say that too. But if we start seeing people saying other things, then it's going to open up our mind a little bit.
Another friend of mine says that one person changing their behavior won't do anything in climate change. So he indicates he may not change his behavior. But I think what you're saying is more important. One person can make a huge impact if that person says what they believe out loud and tries to bring other people with them.
Yeah, There's a climate scientist, I mentioned her before, the one I said who is an evangelical Christian. Her name is Catherine Hayhoe, and she's at Texas Tech, I believe. And she says that the most important thing people can do is talk about it. Because a lot of Americans go through their daily life for months, maybe, without hearing their friends say, hey, I'm concerned about this. And we do take our clues from our friends. We talked about ordinary people. What can ordinary people do? I'm an ordinary person. I mentioned to you when we were setting up this podcast that I don't really see myself as a climate champion compared to some of the other people you've had on this podcast. But in another way, we can all be climate champions by just talking to our friends and saying, hey, I'm concerned about this. I hope you'll think about it.
I consider you a huge climate champion. Based on this conversation, you're doing a lot.
Well, thank you. I appreciate that.
Can you talk about your prior background to show how different it was?
Yeah. So I mentioned that I first heard about climate change when I was back and probably in high school or early college, and that influenced me getting into fusion research in grad school because I viewed it as a carbon-free energy source. Unfortunately, after a few years working that professionally, the funding got cut, and I spent most of my career applying statistics and machine learning and artificial intelligence techniques to business problems. So, for example, I worked on credit card fraud detection at HNC Software and FICO after they merged. It's sort of the same skill set that I learned as a physicist. It's math, it's statistics, it's computer programming applied to very different problems.
So I understand your background wasn't in climate, but I think you've expressed to me that you had some setbacks anyway.
Well, certainly the earliest setback was having the funding cut on this work that I was doing that was in large part motivated by a desire to help the climate. If we can get nuclear fusion working, it's a huge carbon-free source of energy.
You know, I did have Michelle Bechtelsbauer on my show, who is with the Energy Impact Center, and their focus is on solving climate change urgently using primarily nuclear.
Yeah, I'm frequently asked in my talks if I think nuclear is going to be part of the solution, and my answer is, first of all, I've got 3 degrees in nuclear engineering, so I may be a little biased here, but I think at least in the midterm, nuclear is important. The biggest technological challenge we have right now is energy storage. Wind and solar are not baseline running 24/7 sources of power. They provide us a lot of power at times and no power at other times. And if we can't figure out a good way to store that, we're going to have problems. And that's where nuclear power can at least be a bridge, providing that baseline power that we need until we can develop the storage mechanisms that are going to make the renewable sources more viable for providing all our power.
Somebody recently pointed out that in the movie The Graduate, there was a line about what's important, and someone said plastics, and they wanted my perspective on what it is now and energy storage. What else?
Politics. Technologically, we're seeing the price of solar and wind come down dramatically, where it's actually cheaper than coal. I mean, that's the reason coal plants are shutting down right and left around this country, which is great for our carbon emissions going down, is not because environmentalists are winning, quote, the war on coal. It's because natural gas and wind are so much cheaper, and that's going to continue to go.
Technology generally drives why those things become cheaper and also demand for it. So the more you make of it or the more you do the project or the more you manufacture, cost comes down. So that's where government can give support.
Yes, and government has given support. So, for example, when we put the solar photovoltaics on our roof 9-10 years ago now, there was a big tax write-off, and that certainly helped us with the decision to do that. And as prices have come down, the government is rightfully reducing those incentives because they're not needed so much anymore.
I agree. I would like to see some way of moving storage along that timeline faster. I'm not even saying it's with incentives or without, or with technology incentives, but I do think storage needs some help.
Yeah, it does. And there are a bunch of interesting ideas out there. But the issue that I think a lot of people don't understand is fossil fuels are an incredibly dense source of energy. much denser than batteries or anything like that.
They are storage.
Yes. Fossil fuels are stored solar energy from millions of years ago, hundreds of millions of years ago. But it's an incredibly dense source. And if you look at how much batteries you'd need to power Los Angeles for a week, if it's cloudy and there's no wind, it's just unbelievably large amounts. And we run into resource limits on the batteries too. And lithium's not too rare, but it has a lot of energy required to separate it from the ore. But there are other elements, I think cobalt or cadmium, one of the other elements that's involved in these batteries that's actually fairly rare and resource constrained. And it's just not clear if we can build enough lithium ion batteries to give us the storage we need, that we need other approaches.
And I'm not sure that lithium can give us the price we'll need for long-term storage. I think for short-term, if you need to get by a few hours, yes, I think we're okay with lithium. But we need ways of storing energy like we're used to, where we have it stored away if we need it for months.
Mm-hmm. That's the big issue, probably, is, well, short-term storage is an issue now. I mean, if you go to the California Independent System Operator's website, at least I did this a few years ago, and they're talking about what they called the duck curve, as in quack, quack. It's what the utilities have to produce from their main, their coal and their natural gas and their nuclear plants. It starts off high in the morning because there's not much wind, there's not much solar. And I guess that's the duck's head. And then it drops down in the middle of the day because all the solar and wind comes online. And then just as people are getting home in the evenings when the solar drops out and it shoots back up again, and I guess that's the duck's tail. The short-term thing is, can we store things for a few hours from when solar is plentiful to when it's not? And even that, we're running into technological challenges. I mean, we're using lithium batteries, but they're expensive and limited. But yeah, your comment about storing it for months, so the only way we really have now that I'm aware of for doing that is pumped water storage, where you have a reservoir up high and another reservoir down low, and you pump water uphill when you've got excess power, and that can stay there for months. But other than that, I don't know of a good long-term storage mechanism.
I even call that short-term. And the reason is you'll be tempted to use it every day when you need some energy.
Right.
So it's not going to last long-term. To me, long-term storage is when you have so much put away that you can put it away and not think that you need it. And that, I think, we're a long way away from. For me, an example would be biomethane that we put underground. Right now, we do store natural gas. We have months' worth in California. But if that was biomethane, that would be fine. We'd have months of storage. Similarly, if we could safely find a way to make hydrogen by running a solar plant that's very inexpensive, as we talked about before, make hydrogen, store the hydrogen in some way until we need it later on. That would be another long-term methodology, I think.
There is one other technological issue that I don't know of any good solution to right now, and that's jet fuel. You know, it's basically we're going to have to come up with some way of making massive quantities of biojet fuel, and I don't think we're close to that yet. That's the other big technological issue I think we're facing.
Well, if we have a methodology for taking carbon out of the atmosphere, then we can afford to put some in for things we can't replace. I love the rallying cry of 100% renewables or 100% carbon free, but I think we can go very fast to 80%. And I'm excited about doing that before worrying about how we're going to do the last 20. Let's get on with the 80.
Yeah, I agree.
So talk about some of the successes that you've had.
That's actually a hard one, because when I give these talks, I'm getting some feedback from the audience, but I'm not trying to take someone who had previously not accepted the mainstream climate science and totally convert them 100%.
That's not happened yet?
Not that I know of. No one's fallen down on their knees and begged for forgiveness. But what I am hoping is to just cause people to move a little bit more in the direction I want them to move. It's a process, not an end goal. So in terms of those successes, I'm not really seeing them. I guess my successes are more personal. I mentioned earlier that I'm an introvert, that I'm shy. Again, I may not sound like it because I get fired up about this topic. But just getting up the courage to go speak about something that's controversial. I tend to avoid controversy. Speaking about something that's controversial in front of an audience where I might get a harsh reaction was a personal struggle. And so I guess my successes, and this is maybe self-centered, but because I'm not getting definitive feedback from my audiences when I talk or when I go lobby Congress, that's what I kind of have to accept as a success and just imagine, you know, hope, whatever the word is, that I am having an effect on the people in the audience that I want to have an effect on. So those are my successes, I guess.
Those skills probably help you deal with the things you're concerned about in yourself that you want to improve.
Yeah, it makes me feel good when I go out and give a talk. And particularly the last one I gave, there were a couple people from the audience that stuck around for 45 minutes after the talk. They were very engaged. And that is incredibly rewarding. It feels great because you know that at least two people in the audience, you really connected with them. Now, I will admit that they were, at least one of them was very definitely on my side before the talk started. I'm not sure about the second person. But the fact that he stuck around, you know, again, maybe I moved him a little bit in the direction that I was hoping to.
So maybe if somebody else talks to him later, something will move in him that he'll be less negative and maybe even positive one day.
Yeah, and what we really need to do is, again, just get people talking about this and let the politicians know that this is important to us.
What's your vision for the future?
Maybe I've been spending too much time reading the IPCC and national climate reports. I have several visions for the future, and it's basically the ones that are outlined in these reports. There's the bad vision where we just keep on doing what we're doing, and that's horrifying, and that's what motivates me to keep this up. I certainly hope we don't go there. My good vision...
Can you talk about specifics in that bad vision?
The scientists tell us that if we continue to increase our fossil fuel use the way we've been doing, that by the end of this century, we'll be about 7 or 8 degrees Fahrenheit warmer than we were in, say, the year 1900, when my grandparents were born. And that may not sound like a lot. It sounds like a lot to me, but the thing that really brought this home to me is if you look at the difference in the global temperature between the year 1900 and 12,000 years ago during the last ice age, that was also 7 or 8 degrees Fahrenheit. So we're looking at as much climate change in 200 years from 1900 to 2100 as we saw in the prior 12,000 years. And that's what is frightening. And historically, we were hunter-gatherers. If the climate turned bad, we'd pick up our tents and move somewhere else. Well, now we've got national boundaries and way too many people in some areas. One of the really scary things is I'm reading estimates that we may see upwards of 100 million climate refugees later on this century. If you look at the Syrian crisis, where it was maybe 1 million refugees trying to move into Europe, and this caused all sorts of political upheaval and rise of populist movements and terrorist activity from people who don't want the refugees coming in. What are we going to do with 100 million refugees?
You mentioned thousands of years for the climate to change, and now we're talking about dozens of years. At least humans know how to adapt if they have enough time. So 1,000 years, you could figure things out. But when you're talking about tens of years now, we don't have a lot of time to figure it out.
Right, exactly. And there are huge financial costs. I mean, look at Del Mar. They've been fighting with the Coastal Commission over planned retreat in their climate plans. They don't want to put that into their plan because there's many millions of dollars of real estate that are sitting a couple feet above sea level in Del Mar. And if they acknowledge that that might have to be abandoned due to sea level rise, that value of that real estate drops like a rock. And they don't want that.
So I made you talk about the negative vision, but really what I'm after is your positive vision.
You know, I really think that we can come together about this. This is the United States. We've dealt with difficult problems before. We're the greatest source of technological innovation this world has ever seen. Yeah, we have some technical problems, but we can solve these. We are the country that basically changed the course of World War II at great cost to ourselves, but we did it. I am firmly convinced that we can turn the corner on this politically and start moving in the right direction. And we get a world that not only do we not worry about climate change, but if we stop burning fossil fuels, we reduce the amount of smog. We've certainly got enough. I mean, it's better than it was when I was growing up in LA as a kid, but we still have a lot of health effects from common, ordinary smog, which is produced by fossil fuels. We create good jobs that, if you have windmills here in the U.S., they're here in the U.S., and those jobs are going to be here in the U.S. That's a great way to change our economy and create jobs. And we're certainly going to need to create jobs for people that are currently in fossil fuel industry. So I think there's a huge opportunity to make things better by addressing climate change, even ignoring the climate change.
How do you think the world will look in 40 years?
I think we're going to be at a point where the political arguments are mostly gone. I think it's going to be obvious enough by then. There unfortunately will have been enough damage done that it will be obvious, even based on the carbon we've put in the atmosphere now. But with people united around the belief that we need to do something, I think things will happen quickly, that we will have switched to a predominantly renewable and maybe nuclear sources of power. Hopefully nuclear fusion is starting to come online about then. That would be great because it gets us away from a lot of the concerns about our current nuclear fission plants, waste disposal and so on. We'll have had plenty of time to address the storage issues, and even if they're kind of clunky, you know, they'll work. There's one storage thing that's just fascinated me, and I don't know why, and maybe it goes back to playing with Legos as a little kid or something like that, but the idea is to build a big crane, and when you've got excess power, you stack up big concrete blocks.
There is a company that does that, you know.
Yeah, yeah.
Right now.
Yeah, they're sort of in their early proof of concept phase. This is just a silly, simple idea. I mean, it's like, why didn't I think of that? But they're talking about storing 30 megawatt hours in a single tower of concrete blocks. And if you, that by itself doesn't sound like that much, but if you do 30 or 40 of those around your 30 or 40 windmills, then you're getting up to gigawatt hours of storage. And
maybe they can be blocks made as a result of carbon sequestration.
That's an idea. They are talking about using concrete that's come from demolition because it turns out making concrete new is one of the major sources of greenhouse gases being released. We have to cook the limestone, which we're using fossil fuels to heat the limestone up, and then the limestone gives off carbon dioxide to become the lime that we use to make the concrete. So it's about 10% of global emissions are coming from concrete production. So yeah, they want to use recycled concrete, not make new concrete.
Is there anything else you want to say?
I haven't talked about how our bipartisan bill works, but the idea is to put a price on carbon pollution. And basically, we assess a fee on the fossil fuels as they're either mined or pumped out of the ground. And that fee is proportional to the amount of carbon dioxide that will be given off when those fuels are burned. And the fossil fuel producers will pass those costs on to their customers. This will raise the price of fossil fuels, making renewables more attractive. And that allows each individual business and person to decide the way that's best to approach that for their situation. Some businesses may say, wow, I can see that this is going to increase my costs. These fees go up every year to make fossil fuels less and less attractive as we get in the future. And a business may say, well, you know, I can see it 6 years from now, it's going to be more cost effective for me to have a windmill instead of buying electricity from the utility. So I'm going to do that. I'm going to plant a windmill in for 6 years. Other businesses, like I said, we talked about airlines earlier, they may say, hey, I've got to keep burning fossil fuels, even though the price goes up. And they're free to do that.
But it lowers the bar for a replacement.
Yes. And it also incentivizes, like I said, we're a great source of technological innovation here. It incentivizes people to start looking at out-of-the-box solutions to storage or whatever other technical issues we have. And it provides a clear path that they can see that it may this idea may not be financially viable now, but 5 years from now it will. So if I plan my research and development to cover those 5 years, I'll hit the market when it's ready. The downside of
a carbon fee or carbon tax like this generally is they tend to be very regressive. They hit the poor and the middle class hard. Those of us who are lucky enough to be upper middle class, we can afford it. We may not like it, but we can afford it. The second side of our bill is rather than the government keeping that money, they have to turn around and refund it all to the American population on an equal per capita basis. So everybody gets the same amount of money back. Every adult, if you have children in your family, you get a half share for each child. And studies show that 60 to 70% of the American populace comes out ahead financially in this situation. The people, because typically lower income people have smaller carbon footprints than higher income people. Reduced jet travel, reduced size of their house. You don't have as big a house to heat. So you got solar. So you're and that's the point, is some people view this as maybe a wealth transfer from the rich to the poor. And I say no. It's a penalty for those people that have very high carbon footprints. And those of us that do have financial resources, we can make the choice. We can put solar on our roofs. We can buy a plug-in hybrid or a pure electric. We have that choice. And it's up to us to exercise that choice as we see fit, but I certainly hope that people will exercise the choice in a way that helps the environment. Because we all got to live here. Capitalism is great unless you wipe out all your customer base, and then that doesn't work anymore.
Can you talk more about Citizens Climate Lobby, CCL?
CCL was created, I think, about 11 years ago by a man named Marshall Saunders, who lives in Coronado, very close here to San Diego, and that's where our headquarters still is. Most of our staff lives here locally. And he had been involved in various charity and public works endeavors over his life, and he got focused on climate change. And for the first couple of years, he was really drifting around trying to decide how to approach this problem. And it kind of came together around this idea of a bipartisan solution and pushing that. And that's really caught fire. We have, I think, over 100,000 members here in the U.S. There's a big group in Canada. We have chapters all over the world. And it's people that are doing what they can locally in their countries to encourage legislation to address this issue.
I think we owe all of them a big thank you.
Yeah, when I talk about climate champions, there's a lot of people that I see in the CCL organization that I think are the real champions, because they're really devoting their whole life to this for many years at a level of effort that's just amazing, organizing 1,300 people lobbying Congress. That takes a lot of people, a lot of time to get that organized, get all the meetings set up, figure out who's going to meet with whom. It's a really an amazing group of people.
Wow. As I said, we owe them a big thank you. How about a few final words?
Keep up your hope. I mean, there's a lot of people that are convinced we're all going to die in 10 years, and that's not going to happen. Things are serious. We need to deal with this, but we can do this. We will come together, and we will deal with this problem. It's just the longer we wait, the harder it's going to be, and the more serious the consequences are going to be. So the time is now to get going on this.
And with that, I'm going to wrap this up. I'm going to do it with a rap. For someone who's quiet, you certainly were wired. It's hard to believe that you are retired. If it weren't for science, we'd be finished. But luckily, the GHG effect is diminished. As an extrovert, your skills you had to hone because you're an introvert and you were out of your comfort zone. This thing you're doing, it's not just a hobby. You're very, very involved with the Citizens Climate Lobby. The topic of climate change, it is so polarizing. It's more of a conflict than gun control. Unfortunately, a lack of funding, it was an intrusion to your vision of nuclear fusion. Like all of us, you struggle. We all need mercy. You don't like to face controversy. There's a technology that we just don't have yet. We don't have a fuel for a jet. You're really inspired. You're getting out the facts and you're arguing for a GHG tax.
That's amazing. I could never do anything like that. Thank you.
Most guests on The Climate Champions have focused on the weather-related impacts of climate change as how they convey the urgency of mitigation, often considering trying to convince climate deniers as no longer an optimal use of resources. While I understand the perspective, I admire Larry's knowledge and approach to cite data and broad military support, and the Citizens Climate Lobby's efforts to bring more people under the tent. Most agree that the technology we need already exists or can be developed, and that the biggest risks are time and politically motivated roadblocks. Depolarizing climate change as a partisan issue can stabilize policy and enable us to maximize the short time horizon we have left. If you have comments or questions about the podcast, visit my website at www.crevatenergyinnovations.com and drop me an email. I would love to hear from you. And if you're enjoying the Climate Champions podcast series, please subscribe, rate it 5 stars if you're an Apple user, and tell your climate-concerned friends about it. And if you're in San Diego and want to trade your concern about climate change for a few hours of some great laughs, most weekends I'm doing improv comedy at either the Old Town Improv Company or Finest City Improv or both. Contact me to confirm specific show dates. And if you want a release from some of life's stress or to improve your speaking skills, consider taking a workshop at an improv club in your town. Larry's sense of urgency has driven him to overcome personal challenges and fight through the more introverted aspects of his personality. He did his research, identified an organization, Citizens Climate Lobby, that respected his perspective, and took on challenges way beyond his comfort zone. With the support of CCL, Larry is exercising his personal and political power to help mitigate climate change.